Audio.
I'm Clint Emerson, and welcome to Season 2 of Can You Survive This Podcast, where the interview is just as dangerous as the scenarios I put my guests through. From hostage situations to natural disasters, carjackings, active shooters, and more, if you're looking for the skills necessary to survive these situations, then this is the show for you. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Can You Survive This Podcast. Today I got an awesome guest. He grew up performing on stage and in commercials before selling all he had and running off to join the armed forces, where he served as a Navy SEAL for 10 years, earning distinction and experience in combat in places like Kosovo and Afghanistan, returning home decorated and serving as a lead instructor over at BUDS, which is the Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL training. It's also the screening and selection school for men aspiring to be Navy SEALs. He was drawn back into the world of film and television. Thanks for coming on board, Joel Lambert. How you doing, buddy?
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah, awesome, man. So, you know, I always kick these things off a little rapid fire. It serves as a warm-up, but they tend to be kind of fun. So I'm going to give you two choices. You pick the one you like the best, and then we'll circle back around to why you picked what you did. All right, you ready? Here we go. Blonde or brunette?
Brunette.
I'm sure your girlfriend's like, you better say brunette.
Blonde.
Grenade attack or limpet attack?
Ooh, I'd have to say limpet attack. My shoulders aren't so good anymore these days.
Yeah, there you go. Butt plug or ball gag?
Oh, do I have to pick one of these? It depends
no, you
on
don't,
what the ball but... gag's been, but I'll go with ball gag.
Yeah, me too. I think I'd go with that one. Football or baseball?
Baseball.
Yeah. Push-ups or pull-ups?
Pull-ups.
Yeah. GPS or map and compass?
Map and compass.
Bourbon or beer?
Bourbon.
I knew that one, I think. Pizza or hamburger?
Pizza.
Drown to death or burn to death?
Ooh, drown to death.
Indian or Harley?
Ooh, Indian these days.
All right. That was fast, man. You know your answers, and we'll circle back around. So blonde or brunette? I'm guessing your girlfriend's a brunette?
My girlfriend's a blonde.
Okay, so hopefully she's not going to listen to this. We can beep this part.
I'm a brunette.
Yeah. There you go. That's a good answer. I like that. I am the brunette, honey. That's what I meant. Grenade attack or limpet attack? Do you pick limpet attack? For those of you that don't know, a limpet basically is an underwater mine, if you will. It's an explosive device that you can put on the struts or on the shaft of a prop that is attached to a ship. So it's basically you can put these magnetic bombs onto a ship, set the timing device, pull the pins, swim away, and then it'll blow the ship. So limpet attack requires, you know, usually scuba, and then of course a grenade attack is what it is. You pull the pins and chunk grenades at people. And limpet attack. Did you have any experience with that, limpet attack or any of that type of stuff?
Just the training stuff that we all did, swimming limpets in and putting them on the ships and breaking the chem light and shit.
Yeah.
That's about it. But I just said that instead of grenades, because who wants to do a dive operation? But I just don't think I can throw much anymore.
I'm with you, man. I've got both my labrums are torn. So anytime I have to throw something, I wake up the next morning, with like the arm just doesn't work for a day or so.
It'd be sidearming.
Yeah, there you go. Sidearming seems to be the way around it. Okay. And then we did a butt plug ball gag. That one's just more just team guy, dark humor, but you picked the ball gag, which, I think I'd go with ball gag too, right? I don't know. It's kind of odd, but, okay. Football or baseball? You picked baseball. Any reason?
Grew up playing baseball. I never played football when I was a kid, you know, through high school or junior high or anything like that. I wasn't allowed to just because my dad played football. It destroyed his knees and his hips and everything. And he didn't want that for me. So I played baseball instead, loved it. But then, of course, ended up destroying everything in the SEAL teams anyway, so it didn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. End up broken in the end.
Yeah.
Push-ups, pull-ups. You pick pull-ups.
Yeah. Just like pull-ups.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think, that one's a tough one for me because I tend to superset both of those together.
Yeah,
it's great. Know? Yeah, a pull exercise, a push exercise. You can do them pretty much anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
But I think pull-ups are a favorite of almost every team guy I know. Like, I think we pride ourselves on old school pull-ups. None of this CrossFit, like, rapid, whatever the hell they call those things. Yeah. But
pull-ups, we just crank tons of pull-ups. When I was a Buds instructor, that was one of the things I was known for, was leading badass pull-up workouts. And then another age-related thing, when you're doing pull-ups, you drop off the bar. You don't have to get up off the floor.
Yeah, that's right. I like that. Yeah, getting up does get a little difficult, doesn't it?
It's exercise in and of itself.
Yeah, yeah. That's fucking funny. All right. GPS, map, and compass. You pick map and compass.
Yeah, just old school. You got to know your map and compass. You know, your GPS is going to go out. GPS is, you know, anything with a battery. You know.
Yeah. You know? Well, technology, right? It's always going to fail right when you need it. And so, I agree. Have an old school map and compass. I even still keep, Thomas guides in my vehicle.
Especially with everything that's going on right now, I made sure that me and my blonde girlfriend both have atlases in our cars.
Yeah. You just never know. And it's like, I think it's one of those skill sets that's just faded away over time because technology is just in your face so much. And, you know, kids and young adults just have no clue how to even orientate a map properly. Yes. So they know which way to go.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll probably dig into that a little bit when we talk about your
map and compass. If you have that, that's going to take you a long ways.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. Bourbon or beer? You pick bourbon.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got a favorite?
I've got a bunch. I kind of have a little bit of a collection of Scotch whiskeys and bourbons, but I think probably the one that Weller is really good. I like that a lot. And I think my favorite though is Willett. Willett made some incredible bourbons for a long time and they got super popular. And so then they sold their stock out. Instead of it being like 8 or 12 year bourbon, all of a sudden you're able to buy 5 or 7 years. I'm like, okay, they're just getting rid of stuff because they're trying to meet demand. But about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little longer, 7 or 8 years ago, Willett bourbon was incredible.
Yeah. Are they out of Kentucky?
They're out of Kentucky, I believe.
Yeah. Because, I mean, is that still the big differentiator? Like, whiskey is Tennessee and bourbon is Kentucky, right?
Okay, I haven't done my whiskey tours yet since I moved to Tennessee, but I will be, rest assured.
Yeah, that's right. You just got in there. I'm sure there's Jack Daniels. Everybody's there, right?
Everybody's there. I'm going to jump on the scooter here pretty soon and do a little tour.
Yeah, awesome. Pizza or hamburger? Yeah, you picked the pizza.
Yeah, my dog likes pizza.
Dog? Your dog? What kind of dog you got?
Rhodesian Ridgeback.
Oh, nice.
Rose, you
got him with you. Oh, yeah, there he is. Yeah, those are beautiful dogs.
Yeah, she's a good girl.
Yeah. So she's a pizza lover like you then, huh?
Yep.
All right. Drowned to death or burned to death? You said drowned. I agree. Yeah.
It just seems like, I've heard that it really burns when you get the water in your lungs and stuff, but it just seems like it could be a lot more peaceful. Burning doesn't seem like there's anything peaceful about that whatsoever, although you might go into shock sooner and might check out quicker. So,
yeah, it's hard to say, right? But yeah, I think drowning is definitely more appealing than, I guess it depends where the fire starts.
Yeah.
It starts at your feet and works its way up like old school when they used to, tie you to the post and then just light a fire around you. It's like, that would suck.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Fire. I just can't think of a scenario where it wouldn't absolutely suck. So although either one of those are pretty bad, I think the suffocation that would come with, and the peace that comes, that when you're
yeah.
when you go a little too far under that nitrogen narcosis kind of vibe that you get in the water, that might be
That might be a more surreal way to kind of go, right? Like,
It's appropriate for us, you know.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, so there you go, everyone. Go, if you got one to pick, pick drowning. All right, Indian or Harley? And you got, it was a tough one, but you kind of defaulted to Indian, which is my choice too.
Quick, I've been a Harley guy my whole life. I own 3 Harleys. I know them inside and out, and I love them. But this is, at this point, the Harley Davidson Motor Company, I think, has massively thrown themselves under the bus. They got rid of the Dyna, which is really their only modern platform that was making traction with younger people. Now they've got rid of the Sportster and made it some abortion. They had those street. They've just done some really bad things, I think, that are not in line with the people who kept them in business for the last, 50 years.
Yeah.
And then when I rode my first Indian, I got to say that it was everything that Harley should be, as far as the geometry, the handling, the power from the engine, the computer system, the sound system. On my, I have a Street Glide, was one of my Harleys, and I've probably put $5,000 into its suspension and sound system and stuff, trying to get it to the level where a Indian starts off at, that you get a stock Indian with the, the sound packages and everything on it. So absolutely. I'm 100% in on Indian. Harley has not done us any favors and has not, Harley's walked away from their core audience and is trying to recreate themselves, which I understand they're trying to survive in this world, but I would rather spend my money on a company that's doing it right.
Yeah, I'm with you. I was the first Indian you rode when we were in DC, when you rented that one. It was like a Challenger, I think.
Yeah,
that thing. I ended up getting a Challenger as well. I got the Dark Horse all blacked out, and I had a Street Glide, and it was just night and day. I know that I can reliably get from point A to point B now on that Indian. Whereas when we were in DC, Rolling Thunder before COVID, and we sat on 95 in gridlock, remember that? That Harley about died on, it did die on me several times. It just couldn't handle the heat, and it was just a pain in the ass to drive cross country. And after getting the Challenger, I'm like, holy crap, man. And plus, they've put a lot of sport bike engineering into a cruiser, into a bagger, and that's where they win.
The Indian doesn't have yet, but I think is forthcoming, is the aftermarket. The one great thing about Harley-Davidson is they've got one of the biggest aftermarkets in existence.
Yeah.
Awesome. Because we all like to tweak our bikes, and Indian doesn't
have that
yet, but it's coming along.
I think so. I put those zombies on my bike, and that thing is now obnoxiously loud. It is so freaking loud, man. I think it just annoys the hell out of, it makes Harleys sound like Hondas now.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I know you're there, man.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's get in more about you. So Joel Lambert. You grew up in TV and film. I didn't know that.
A lot of plays and things like that. And always wanted to be an actor. And then did a bunch when I was up through college and such. And that was kind of where I was making all my money when I was going through college. And then afterwards, before I dropped everything and went into the Navy. And so when I kind of got sucked back into that, it wasn't like it was an unknown thing, or it wasn't like it was something I had no experience with, getting with agencies and auditioning and go-sees and all the stuff like that. It was all a familiar world to me. So it was something I thought I'd never go back to.
Yeah.
When I walked away from that and went into the Navy, I thought, okay, here I'm going dark for life. You know what you think when you're, what it's going to be like. And then it just didn't work out that way. And, sometimes you just got to ride the horse the direction it's going.
Yeah. No, that's cool. And was there anything notable that you did in college that people would know about, or a big commercial or anything?
It was mostly, I did a couple national commercials, but most of the stuff I did then was print work, commercial work, things like that. I didn't do anything that anyone would really know of at that point.
Don't run away. More with former Navy SEAL Joel Lambert after the break. Well, I think that is a distinguishing feature between you and other SEALs. You know, there's a, for those of you listening, the West Coast is known, you know, nicknamed like Hollywood SEALs, right? Because they tend to do the SEAL thing for a little while and then, you know, end up either, you know, as, you know, tactical advisors in Hollywood, stuntmen, or even actors. And, but you've got, you actually had a history in it before you became a Hollywood team guy.
You know, the thing is that it's interesting you bring that up because it was something that I never thought I'd get back into. I completely left.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of presented itself to me. It was the way for me to go. And then these days with everything, like you're talking about all the books and all the movies and all the guys getting involved in Hollywood, you're seeing a lot of dudes come in to the teams, looking at it as a stepping stone into politics or into, you know, whatever it might be that they want to do. And I feel kind of bad about contributing to that. But at the same time, all of us that are doing this now, for the most part, I mean, there are a few outliers that we won't name that I think aren't doing it properly, in my opinion. But we all got into the teams going to be team guys. That's all we wanted to do. We weren't trying to use it as a stepping stone to, you know, launch our political career or write a book or anything like that. It was, we wanted to be team guys. We wanted to go kick doors with brothers and be part of something that was much bigger than ourselves. And then how this came out of it, it just seems to be a purer, cleaner kind of way. And now it seems to be that guys are using the teams as stepping stones, and that's not, and you can't go into it like that.
Right. You know? Yeah. I'm with you. I went in, I mean, I wanted to be a SEAL since I was 10 years old. I met the first one and I didn't know what they were until he told me some stories and I was sold.
Yeah.
And then went in and, you know, I was a quiet professional, you know, for the 20 years I was in. And then when I got out, I sat in the squadron space seeing these dumbasses on Fox News and CNN and all these team guys doing what they're doing. And I was sitting there going, these guys are fucking idiots. Like all of them, right? I was just kind of lump summing anybody that was doing anything on TV or writing books. I was like, these guys are all fucking, you know, tools. Yeah. But then, you know, I have become one of them. So, you know, it was,
I would draw a distinct line in that. And I judge harshly on this, as I'm sure all of us do, but I see guys that are doing stuff like you and a few other dudes writing books and stuff that have something to say and they have something to give. And I think that is a very distinct line, and some dead space between that and some of the guys who are writing other people's stories. I know, you know, I'm talking about going on Fox News and stuff and talking about shit they don't know anything about.
Right.
I see, but just because they're a Navy SEAL, they're on there. I went on Banfield the last several weeks ago. I was on her show 3 nights in a week talking about the Brian Laundrie manhunt. And because I know a lot about that. And so I was going on the news talking about escape and evasion and man tracking and all of that. But they've called me so many times to go on news shows, especially when my show was airing, just for random shit, you know,
right?
Navy SEAL. And this is something that kind of sort of brushes up against the tactical world. Do you have an opinion you want to tell the world about? No, because I'm not the guy for that.
Right.
Know your place. And when you bring what you are authentically to it, and you're not writing, another thing that drives me crazy is when guys create their careers on the laurels of our collective reputation. You know, the way I felt about what I was doing in Manhunt is I'm out there actually doing it against foreign adversaries. It's all on me. And yeah, I'm wearing the trident and I'm carrying that reputation with me, but I'm doing it every day and it's completely on me. It's not like I'm doing it just because, hey, I'm a Navy SEAL and we're really good at this. And so, you know, here, just buy my book or watch my show because all the other guys who have really done real things, you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, there's a difference, I think, in the what you bring to the table and how you present yourself.
I think that's where I've ended up as well, is, you know, it's all about staying in your lane and knowing your own left and right flanks and not thinking that, oh, just like you said, you know, a news agency calls or a newspaper calls. And I'm like you, I turn more down than I accept because I don't want to venture outside my lane. My lane has been this kind of crisis management and, you know, survival skill world. And it's fun. I like it. It entertains me. I get to learn something new all the freaking time. Especially, you know, I'm going to learn something from you in about 2 minutes when we start talking about Manhunt. But, yeah, I think it's important that no matter what you do, you got to maintain your own left and right flanks and try not to go outside of those, because as soon as you do, it starts messing with your own credibility. Totally. with the core things that you do in life, you know? So
all about authenticity, you know, authenticity and pure, yeah, organic, what you bring to the table. And you bring a lot to the table and have given a lot to the world through your books and through your podcasts and stuff like that. And it's all authentic, you know? So nobody's gonna, I mean, there's always gonna be the team guys, like anybody who's on TV, they're gonna be giving shit to, but
yeah,
you know.
Well, I tell people all the time, SEALs are, you know, 50% of them hate you and 50% of them love you.
Yes. So hate you come up to you when no one else is around and go, hey, if you ever need something, you know, if you ever, you know,
yeah,
you want a little, someone else to do a little work or do a little specialty extra gun handling, you know, give me a call.
Yeah, exactly. Or they'll hit you up or they'll DM you and say, hey, can you hook me up with, you know, I'm like, uh-huh. Yeah. I remember telling people a long time ago, I said, whether you love me or hate me, I will still hook you up. I don't care. It's okay.
It's all about family, man.
That's right. So you're in college. What was the trigger for you that said, hey, I'm going to leave kind of this acting and all this stuff I've been doing behind, and now I'm going to go become a Navy SEAL? What was that trigger?
It was, I kind of understand it now, but at the time I didn't. And what happened was I just started having this nagging feeling that, I saw the road ahead of me. And it was a wide boulevard with streetlights and beautiful houses. And it just marched on and on and on. And this was life ahead of me. But off to the left, there was this break in the fence. And there was this dark trail that was going off through the woods. And it wasn't even hardly a trail. It was just like a track that had been overrun and overgrown. But somehow I knew back there was where life was. And I mean, I'm just kind of speaking symbolically, but what it was I needed to find something that challenged me spiritually, mentally, and physically, and go climb that mountain. And not because of the peak, but because of the journey. And it was a very Jungian kind of archetypal, the hero's quest, the hero's journey that Joseph Campbell talks about all the time, that we all, especially as men, have to go on, which Star Wars was a perfect rendition of, you know, Luke Skywalker meeting the Oracle, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and leaving his hometown and going on this quest and, and then finally returning home a more complete version of the human that you left as. And so that's really what it was. And I didn't know what it was I wanted to do, but something was calling me out of just regular life. And so I started thinking, what am I going to do? Am I going to climb Mount Everest? Am I going to go, you know, be an extreme sports guy, or go to India and sit in an ashram for 10 years? You know, all these things crossed my mind. I didn't know what would fulfill that itch. And then I thought back to when I was about 10 years old and my dad, one of his friends, came over for dinner. And this dude was a Navy guy and he had gone through some bizarre, we had dinner. And then afterwards, my dad and this guy were sitting in the living room having coffee. And I was just kind of sitting there being seen and not heard. And this guy started telling my dad about this weird Navy program he was in, the Navy Whales or something like that. And he was talking about how his hands were tied up behind his back and his feet were tied together. And he was thrown in the deep end of the pool to survive. And he swallowed water and he drowned, and they pulled him out and revived him and asked him if he wanted to go back in again. He said, no, fuck that, I'm done. And I thought, I was a swimmer growing up. I was on the swim team. I was always in the pool. I was the kid they're blowing the whistle at the end to get them out of the pool at the end of the session. And every time I got in the pool after that story, I thought, what would it be like to be tied up in the pool, having to survive? And of course, now I know that was the SEAL program, it was BUDS, and that was drown proofing, which isn't that crazily difficult of an evolution in BUDS, comparatively speaking. But to a 10-year-old kid, you know, thinking about being tied up and thrown in the pool, that's some crazy shit, man. Crazy shit.
Yeah.
And so I thought, what's the one thing that still scares me? That scares me. I'm still scared of that. And what's the one thing that I'm not sure I can do? I know if I put my mind to it, I could climb Mount Everest and I could, you know, go be an extreme, you know, hang glider or whatever. But could I make it through SEAL training? I'm not sure. So what do I have to do? That is what I have to do. I cannot not do that. I cannot go through life knowing that this is a thing that scared me the most and I turned away from it. And so I went down to the recruiter, talked to him, bought all the books I could. And there weren't that many at the time, you know, a bunch of Vietnam books and stuff about SEAL teams. So I read all the Vietnam books I could and started training. Bought myself an old pair of surplus flat foot paratrooper boots and started running my ass off and swimming every day.
That's awesome. Yeah. And it sounds a lot like kind of, I think we all did that because it was kind of got the old school. We got the last of the old school world, you know, it was before there were Bates lights, you know, you remember Bates lights that came, they issued. Yeah. Yeah. And what Bud's class were you in?
I was 220 until hell week. And then I was double rolled and I graduated in 222.
Okay. And injuries, I'm guessing.
Oh yeah. We were summer hell week. And so my boat crew was one of the top two or three boat crews. We put out like crazy. And so everyone but one dude in our boat crew got stress fractures in our legs. And so I had bilateral stress fractures in both femurs. And so it was a double roll. And, you know, and jump back in. It was crushing at the time that happened, but, you know, it all worked out.
Yeah. That's that resiliency that, a lot of guys just have to have, you know?
Yeah. That's what it is.
Yeah. Get up and keep moving. Even when you get hurt, you know, it just sucks, but time will go by and eventually you're back in the saddle.
Exactly. And I mean, it's hard and it's hard marking that time, but the alternative is to quit and it's to end and to have that hanging around your neck for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I mean, the 222 doesn't sound, that's not a bad class number, 222, right?
Yeah. That's triple deuce. Yeah. I think we sung that when we ran onto the grinder one time, we got the shit beat out of us for not saying 222 and saying, calling ourselves a triple deuce.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not a bad number. Well, so, okay. So you did your time, you got to go to Kosovo. Where else did you get to play around in?
Kosovo and Afghanistan are the only places that we did anything real. I mean, we got to do some great J sets before 9/11.
Yeah, yeah.
We're still a thing. I don't know if they're still even doing those now, but we had some great ones, a lot of Eastern Europe, a lot of fun stuff. And then we did our 6 weeks in Kosovo, which was really stoked on at the time because it was the only game in town. But then, of course, I was deployed when 9/11 happened. And right at the end of my deployment, of course, we didn't send guys in immediately, at least guys from the vanilla team. So I went home and when the next cycle, then we went to Afghanistan with Team 4. And that was amazing. And then I went to Buds.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. And then were you in first? So when you went to Buds, was it first phase, second phase?
Oh, second phase. I was going to college. So I went to second phase, which was awesome. The guys in second phase were great and it was awesome working with the students who had already been through Hell Week. So you kind of weeded out most of the absolute jokers that didn't need to be there. And so you had students that you could work with that you could take a little more seriously. I actually really enjoyed my time as a Buds instructor. It felt like it was really full circle. Some guys didn't. Some guys just wanted to get out of there and get back into the team. And I thought it was actually a really beneficial and something where you could really, I mean, I remember a whole bunch of my Buds instructors. I'm sure you do too. You have the chance to give these guys something to show them, to instill in them some sort of understanding of the frog family and what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to be and what brings value to the community and not just, you know, doing all the things you're supposed to and getting your collateral duties done and stuff like that. But, you know, what do you do when you're with one of your brothers and he's being a total asshole. He's about to start a fight in a bar. You know, I mean, they're just ways that things you need to know to fit in this group of knuckle dragging.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
group of men that we are, you know?
Yeah. It's the first place where you get that cultural awareness, right? I mean, I remember showing up to the Buds quarter deck to check in and at that moment in time, there stands Danny Chalker, right? He's the Command Master Chief of Buds. He's in his working whites, service whites. He looks, you look up at him and you're like, holy shit, that's the guy that, it's Snake Eyes that, you know, Dick Marchenko refers to in Rogue Warrior. And, you know, he's standing in front of me right now.
The mustache.
Yeah. And he is the iconic Frogman.
Yes. I mean, exactly what you think of when you think of like the real old school Frogman.
Yeah. Right. And there stands this badass who's a plank owner of Damneck and has this history. And I'd read about him in a book. And I was just like, holy shit, now he's standing in front of me. And that, I mean, that then you're like, okay, this is like, this is real. And then you get into first phase. And my first phase instructors are pretty much all the guys that were in the movie The Rock with Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage, right? So it was Joe Haas, right? Uh-huh. Joe Haas was this, you know, machine. And he was, he had tried out as like a running back for the Raiders when they were in Los Angeles back then. But just a great guy. But all those guys' personalities is what, how you learned the culture was through how they talked, how they act, how they, even how they yelled at you. You felt, oh, okay, this is how I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
So that you would hopefully show up to a SEAL team later and actually, you know, continue to carry the torch of that old school Frogman mentality. But unfortunately, it sounds like it's changed in a big way. And these younger team guys don't get to experience that piece, which is unfortunate.
It is unfortunate because that's, I think, one of the greatest things about the SEAL teams. I mean, just that, not the camaraderie per se, but the, just that respect and that understanding and that man tribe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important, you know, and I think that's why, you know, guys, you and me and heck, a bunch of other dudes that kind of got a taste of the old school, end up finding our way back to each other. If it's through the Frogman MC or, you know, whatever other platforms there are, it's pretty interesting to see how the like-minded guys all find their way back to each other in some form or fashion, which is really cool.
Absolutely. Because yeah, it becomes something so valuable to me. And it's not, it becomes even like the loyalty and the ties aren't necessarily to the person that you're giving that loyalty to. It's your loyalty is, that's what has been put into you and what you hold in such a high esteem from the experiences that we have had. It creates in you, it's not because I necessarily, like we were talking earlier before we started airing, it's not necessarily because I like you so much or because you're my best friend of the teams, but it's because of the shared bond that we have. I'm still going to hook you up. I'm still going to take care of you because it's about me, not about you.
Right. Yeah, totally. And that's why, I mean, my personal passion, and if you watch my any of my social feeds, is usually I'm promoting others. And I'd rather promote others than promote myself, you know. So any guy that I can push out there, I will. And it doesn't matter if they like me or not, you know, like I said at the beginning, it's all good.
I love that, man. I love that level of support and taking care of and being, I'm so always thrilled when I see another team guy doing really well for himself.
I mean, me too, man.
Exceptions for the guys that we talk about that have, you know, maybe sold our community out a little bit. But aside from that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every time I see a team guy doing well for himself, I'm ecstatic. I want to do well.
Right. I'm with you. If team guys are crushing it, then it serves everyone well in the end, and it keeps the community's reputation alive.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm with you, like the sellout part. I always tell people, like, well, you know, I'm not the first, I'm not the last. And if I don't do it, somebody else will. So, you know, and that pretty much relates to anything, you know, in life. Right. So why not? If you have those chances, and not to mention, I don't have the leash of Uncle Sam anymore, so I really don't give a fuck. Don't run away, okay? We got more to follow with Joel Lambert after the break. All right, so let's talk about, one of the most popular things, or maybe the most popular thing you've done since you got out was Manhunt on Discovery Channel, right? I mean, that thing. How many? So tell me about, like, first, let's talk about what was Manhunt and then dive into like the most extreme experience you had doing it.
Oh, dude, I got so many stories for that. But the way, so Manhunt, I had just gotten out and I had moved up to Los Angeles because I was doing a lot of film and TV stuff. I had a background in acting. I had some training. I had all that. And I started getting all these opportunities up in LA in front of the camera and behind. And I thought, you know, this isn't where I expected I would be. You know, I thought I was going to be in the teams forever, but I'm smashed up now and I'm getting out. And, you know, these opportunities are presenting themselves. I have the training. I've got a background. It would be stupid to not take advantage of them. And so I moved up to LA, you know, just a couple hours from San Diego and with another team guy. And I just started auditioning and doing some film and TV work. I was doing some little guest stars and co-stars on scripted television and little bit parts in movies and stuff. And then a friend of a friend calls me up and he says, hey, I've got this friend who is putting together a television show and he's looking for former special operations guys with a strong background in escape and evasion and in tracking. And well, I had those skill sets and those proclivities. And so I sent my resume and stuff to my friend who sent it to his friend. The guy called me up immediately and was like, oh my God, this is great. You know, can we do some interviews? And so we did some interviews and talked on the phone a few times. And just to give you a little context to this, everybody in LA has a script, has a TV show they're developing, has a movie that they've written, has something in development. It's just, you know, you don't take it that seriously unless it's Rob Reiner, you know, unless somebody has a background in this. So I did a couple on camera, like Skype interviews with this guy. We talked quite a bit. He had this show. It was basically an E&E channel that he was trying to set up an escape and evasion channel. And they'd do a documentary or a reality type show where they'd follow, you know, somebody in a escape and evasion scenario. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. You know, I know all the tracking and I've have a bunch of escape and evasion. Kind of that's kind of where my proclivities and stuff had fallen, you know, when I was in the team and afterwards. And so all the survival, all the tracking, all that kind of stuff, booby traps and primitive skills. And so we were talking back and forth and the guy goes, okay, hey, we're going to go out to Palm Desert this weekend and I want to shoot some stuff on you. Can you come out and let me shoot some stuff for my little sizzle reel? And I'm like thinking, okay, I've already spent a whole lot of time with this dude, helping him develop his thing. And now he wants me to go out to Palm Desert, run around and help him make his sizzle reel so he can go off and try and pitch this show wherever he's going to pitch it. I'm like, you know, dude, I'm sorry. I just don't really have the time to spend on it anymore. He goes, well, I'll pay you. I'm like, okay, well, the guy's going to pay me $300 to get me in a hotel room to go out to Palm Desert. I'll run around for 3 or 4 hours and let him shoot his little bullshit. And then I'll go off to J Tree climbing or something, you know, I'll have a nice weekend outside of LA. So that's what I do. So I go out, I'm driving out to Palm Springs and I'm pulling up the address that he gave me for the hotel. And I'm pulling down this long driveway and these palm trees are, you know, passing my car. And I pull up this huge turnaround drive where there's like this beautiful resort. There's like Bentleys and Ferraris parked in front of this resort. I'm like, wow, this dude's really shelling out to, you know, to put us in a nice place. And so I go check in, I go to my room and the phone rings and I pick it up. I'm like, hello. And this woman says, hi, Mr. Lambert. I know you're not scheduled to work till tomorrow. I'm so-and-so. I'm the production coordinator. But I'm wondering, Sarah Davies, the vice president of Discovery International, just flew in from London. And she's wondering if you'll have dinner with her tonight. And at that point, the light bulb goes off above my head. And I'm thinking, well, maybe this is actually something real. It's actually something. It has some wheels. It has some legs underneath it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I go out to dinner with Sarah and the two guys who created this the show, and we have dinner and we end up drinking too much bourbon and end up telling her a story of some raunchy stories that I probably shouldn't have told, you know, team guy type stories. Yeah. I got a little bourbon in me and, you know, started flowing. Well, she loved it. She's this big British woman, just all brassy and all kinds of foul mouthed. And so we got along fantastically. The next day we go out and shoot this stuff. And it turns out that they've got me, they've got a SAS guy. They flew in from Hereford. They're looking at, and they had a Marine as well, that they were looking at all three of us for this show. Mm-hmm. And so we just ran around in the desert and talked about tactics, and I built a booby trap, and they wanted me to bring some stuff to build a booby trap. And I brought a few things. I didn't put any thought into it. And so we get out there, I'm like thinking, oh, this is real. And so I build a deadfall booby trap tripwire with just some telephone cord and stuff I found out there in the desert. And it was awesome. And they loved it. And so then, it was just one of those things in life where sometimes you just know in your knower that, that something is, it's almost prescience, you know, what's going to happen and you know, it's perfectly right. And you know, it's for you. And that's what I knew when this went on. And so they called me like a week later and said, you're the one who got it. We're going to do it with you. We're going to present it at Discovery Channel with you. We're going to shoot a pilot. I'm like, awesome. I wasn't surprised. I knew. And so we went out, we shot a pilot episode, and then it got picked up for series. And we did two seasons internationally. It aired in 240 different countries and territories globally. The only country it did not air in that I'm aware of is Canada, which is very strange. But it aired every place else. And it was awesome. And I would insert in foreign countries. I would skydive in places I wasn't supposed to be. I'd, you know, cross borders under trucks. I'd swim up from the ocean, and somehow I'd ping that country. They'd be expecting me, like, Joel's going to show up this week between Monday and Friday, sometime between 6 a.m. and 9:45 a.m. And that's all, you know. And so they'd be standing by, and then I would do a pre-planned ping. I'd send up a flare or smoke, or I'd cut a electrified fence or something to let them know where I was at. And then they would respond, and the hunt was on. And for 2 to 4 days, I would be doing escape and evasion. I'd be doing anti-tracking, counter-tracking. I'd be setting booby traps. I'd be laying deception trails. And they would take all of their special operations force, their fugitive recovery team, or their specialty tracking unit would use their dogs, their drones, their FLIR, whatever they had, they would come after me with and try to track me down and take me down before I made my extract point. And it was awesome and brutal.
Yeah, dude, that sounds like so much fun. But let's just clarify. The series, or should I say the network, pretty much gave host countries very little information, but had to get their approval, right? You weren't just rolling in there. I mean, there was a little bit of that setup, right?
It was laid out like you were doing FTX or a full mission profile kind of thing. So what was really awesome about it, because we've done things like this before, but we never had all the assets assigned to it. So what we'd do is when we were developing the season, we would come up with a list of like 10 or 12 different possibles. Mm-hmm. We would reach out to those different countries and those different units and see if they're interested. And from there, we'd maybe have 6 or 7 that were interested. And then we'd start negotiating with them and seeing if it would work out, because these were all active units. And so they had deployment schedules, they had work schedules. And so we'd have to figure out how we could film all the episodes in sequential order and fit in with these countries' schedules and availabilities. And so,
yeah, gotcha.
Full development. And then there would be a back and forth of, you know, where it's going to be. And they would negotiate on what part of the country it would be, and what assets they would use, what assets they wouldn't use. They really could use any assets they wanted. They just had to disclose so we could put cameras in those assets. Although, of course, you know how it goes. Everyone cheated. So there were a lot of assets that got used. A lot of stuff ended up that happened that didn't end up on the show.
Yeah, I bet.
It was awesome. And so we would plan this out. And so then the country would know, you know, I'd come in and we'd sit down and we'd all sign contracts and we'd all shake hands. We'd all meet each other. And then they would know that, you know, there would be like a 3-day window or a 4-day window. And we'd give them a time window within those 3 or 4 days, you know, from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on either Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, it's going to happen. And so just be watching your normal things. And then we would come up with a way for me to let them know based on what they actually did. So I would kind of mold my E&E plan and the tools I would use and the booby traps I would use and all of that around kind of what they actually are used to dealing with on a regular basis. So I did one in South Africa in a Kruger National Park. And so I kind of acted like and conducted myself like a poacher would. And then in Poland, they had a lot of Eastern European people smuggling and crossing through their woods into Western Europe. And so I kind of conducted myself in that manner, you know, using the tools and kind of moving in that same way. Of course, I'm using all the stuff I have at my disposal, but we kind of wanted to gear it in the method that they're used to working.
Yeah. And then they get some training out of it as well by having to try and. Yeah.
I mean, they got to track and try to take down someone who has a skill sets and motivation much higher than their general, you know, a person. And then I get to do an escape and evasion exercise against a country using all of their assets.
Yeah. You
they're using global hawks, or they're using hardcore FLIR units, or they're using, in fact, sometimes when they use things they're not supposed to, they're using mobile phone triangulation vehicles to try to triangulate the producer's cell phone. That happened in South Korea. They don't know that I know, but I know.
Yeah, I gotcha. Wow, that is so cool. And now, for each of those countries, what were your takeaways for the listener? You cross, you get in, which I would say black, right? You have white, gray, and black is the color codes for how you get into countries. And so you were going in pretty much black. Yeah. And then what were your priorities as far as like when it came to water and food and all that? How did you kind of?
That's a good question. So I would have to, when I would plan this out, I would usually have a week to 2 weeks to plan my evasion out. And so I'd have a map and I would know my extract point. They wouldn't know my extract point. So I would know my insert and my extract point. And so I would, I would map different possible routes. So I would have four or five different routes that were possibilities, depending on what they do. What they do is going to drive me in different directions. And so along those routes, depending on the environment I'm in, of course, there's water considerations, there's food considerations, there's temperature considerations, there's temperature differential, night and day, you're in the desert. There were a lot of different things I'd have to take into consideration. Water was probably the biggest one. Most cases. So, you have your rule of threes, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food, or three hours without shelter, three days without water, 3 weeks without food. So you have to prioritize your, what you need to do, your shelter, your water, your food, according to the environment and the time constraints and the weather and where you're at. So I would plan everything out and I would be like, oh, there's just a really cool pond on the map. If that's actually there, I could do a really cool deception around there. And it looks like there's some sparse trees here. So I could set some booby traps and then I could ditty them out off here at like about, about 270. And I could probably leave them confused there for a couple hours. And so I would prepare just rough ideas of deceptions and booby traps. And I would then prepare, what I would need for those in my little E&E kit. And so then if I happen to find myself in that area, if based on what they did in tracking and chasing me, drove me to that area, I would have something kind of halfway thought out already planned that I could pull out of my ass and set up there. So I gotcha. Had a chance to, I would do a lot of homework on a lot of map study, a lot of homework because, I couldn't drive the, they were driving where I was going really. I just had flexible and have enough contingencies planned out that no matter where they drove me, I would have a plan and I wouldn't just be running.
Don't think about switching to some other podcast. We will come out of your phone or whatever device you're listening to and hit you across the face. More with Joel Lambert after the break. Right. Yeah, I like it. Now, did you carry a water filter?
Yeah.
Just to simplify. So what was your favorite water filter you used?
Well, I would carry a couple different ones. I generally wouldn't carry a filter. A lot of times I just carry iodine tablets. It would depend. I mean, if I'm in some place with like swampy, a lot of murky water, then I would carry a filter because, you got to filter the sediment out. But honestly, for this kind of stuff, for E&E corridors and for running, a Sani straw, I thought was the best portable water.
Yeah.
So you can just wear it around your neck, it lasts forever. And I can suck out of a mud puddle. I can suck out of a nicely running stream, but I would always have iodine tablets. That was kind of my go-to.
Yeah. The PuriTabs and stuff. Yeah. They got so many different variations these days that you can just throw two tabs in and boom, you got good water without it. It's virus and bacterial, free.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is huge in order to keep going. And then I'm guessing sometimes you just said, fuck it, and probably just starved, right? Because you knew you're only going 2 to 4 days.
If I had the chance, I would always familiarize myself with the medicinals and the edibles in the area. And then also venomous snakes and all the other stuff. So I would know, I don't have all that in my mind bank. I would, research each place I'm going in. So I know.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times, like when I was in Africa, I walked through some fields of termites and I just grab termites and eat those. So you have something that you're eating. It's not going to give you a lot of sustenance, but if you can just grab a couple of grasshoppers or locusts you know, there's something in your stomach, there's something there to keep it from growling, or you can get a snake, that's great. Or, you know, some edible leaves or flowers, that's great. But most of the time it was just exactly what you said, fuck it and starve. And then there were a couple yeah. times that on the water situation. Now, you know, to everybody out there listening, never drink untreated water when you're out. Just even if it's a pure mountain stream, something might be dead up ahead, upstream, and you just don't know it. It always pays to filter your water. But there were a few times when I'm like, there's like 4 hours left or 2 hours left, or I'm only 400 meters through the jungle to my extract point. And I'm like, I need something to drink. I'm not going to wait 45 minutes for my tabs to work. I'm just going to drink that water, because if I get dysentery, I'm going to be back at the hotel and I won.
So yeah,
the win is smaller than the window for the bacteria. Right. Amoebic infection to hit me. So I just said, fuck it.
Just do some quick math and be like, okay, gulp, gulp, gulp.
Like, I hope this doesn't, you know, ruin my weekend once I'm back at the hotel.
That's awesome. Yeah, man, what a great experience. Now that, so once you did two seasons of that, then what kind of came after that?
Well, after the first season, a manhunt was really popular. We did a bunch of press. It was fantastic. I was having a great time. And they then gave me a second show called Predators Up Close. And that aired on Animal Planet mostly, and on Discovery in some countries, where we would go interact with some of the world's biggest predators, great whites, polar bears, lions, and hyenas. And they built this special dome, this little geodesic dome out of aluminum and plastic. And we would build this dome and kind of encourage these animals to come up and attack the dome. And we'd have bite strength meters and things like that. And I would be in the dome filming them and, you know, getting attacked by these giant animals. And that was awesome. And I picked that one because I just thought, how cool would it be to be in a little aluminum and plexiglass tent while a polar bear climbs on top and tries to, you know, break in. I'm like, that's badass stuff. And so I did that. And I remember we were doing it with great whites. So this actual pod that we made, it was amphibious. So it dropped into the water off of the shark ship, and the pod had these big holes in it. So the sharks couldn't get all the way in, but I could reach out. And so these great white sharks would come attack this pod, and we're filming it, and it's just badass. But what was really cool is the shark would come swimming up and on this pod, and then would kind of back off and turn sideways and swim off. And these, you know, 15-foot great whites are right there, and I'm reaching out, grabbing their gills, grabbing their pectoral fins, you know, petting these great white sharks. And I remember I had comms, you know, full face mask, and I had comms to the top. And the director, who's British, he's like, Joel, are you reaching out and grabbing the sharks? And I'm like, fuck yeah, yeah, these are great white sharks. And when am I going to get a chance to grab a great white shark again? And he's like, please, insurance would like you to keep your hands and feet inside the pod. And I'm like, no fucking way, dude. So I'm grabbing every shark I can. I'm like, come on, dude. When you get a chance to grab a great white shark, you take it.
Yeah, you definitely checked a bunch of bucket lists that no one else would ever write down as a bucket list item.
Guys like us.
Yeah, it's usually only team guys that have these very distorted versions of what's cool. Yeah.
The thing that was cool that a lot of people didn't think was cool is we did a 2-part special on Fukushima. So we actually got to go to Fukushima after the meltdown. I got to go in the actual destroyed reactors. And I was wearing a radiation, I can't remember what you call it, radiation meter.
Geigameter or whatever.
Something like that. Yeah. That was measuring my how much radiation I took over the course of the filming. And once it hit the total, I was, you know, I couldn't get back on the place. But that was a fascinating thing to go there and hear the whole stories and watch everything and see what that actually happened and see the melted down reactors. And it was pretty crazy stuff, man.
Damn, man. Yeah, that's a lot of cool stuff.
It's cool.
Yeah, you've gotten to experience several, life's worth of just cool shit, I would say.
I think that's pretty common for team guys and guys like us. I mean, we go in the teams, and that's, of course, is a lifetime in and of itself. But then skill sets, just like what you're doing, the skill sets you brought out, there are so many ways to leverage and share those in authentic and beneficial ways that we get to keep doing this.
Yeah, no doubt. It's a whole lot of fun. And You know, I think the key is just how do you just try not to be bored, you know? And it's like the other piece of the equation I tell people all the time is when you professionally take risks, then you personally start to become a risk taker as well. I mean, it's not a surprise that if you're getting paid to take risk, then it's going to bleed into your personal life. And then before you know it, you're just always doing risky stuff.
Yeah.
And sometimes guys don't know how to handle that and they do bad risky things. Or there's good risky things, like, you know, diving with sharks and hanging out with polar bears. That's good risky things besides,
yeah, I think for us, guys like us, when getting the risky things, you know, that we did in our training and in our careers, we see the benefit of that. Like it's an enlightenment experience almost. I mean, these kinds of near death or just saying, fuck it, I'll die, I'm going to get this done. Those kind of moments create revelation and like little glimpses into enlightenment, and it elevates us. And so it's not an adrenaline rush. It's not an adrenaline addiction to why I still take risks and why I do these things. It's because in those moments of choosing death, that's where life really is.
Yeah. I kind of see where you're going with that. And for me, it was a deeper appreciation, right? You do something that's kind of like, what the fuck? And then afterwards you're like, you know what? I really, you really do enjoy the smaller things a whole lot more than if you'd never experience that kind of stuff or, you know, have any kind of risk in your life. But I also equate it to just testing your will, right? Yeah. You got to test your will at least once a year. And it serves as a reset. Like you can just, it allows you to keep moving forward in a progressive way rather than just sitting stagnant, you know, doing what you're doing all the time.
1,000%. And there's a Zen saying, I'm going to completely mangle and put in my own words. Basically, it's you have to die before you die to really live.
Yeah, there you go. I like that. Sounds like a good tattoo. All right. So now this whole enlightenment, as soon as you said enlightenment, that kind of draws me into the next topic for you, and that's the psychedelics. So are you sold on psychedelics, and is this a regular thing, or did you just kind of experience it and like, all right, that was cool?
No, it was, I am 100% sold on it. I got plugged into the psychedelic program in Mexico that a lot of the guys are going down to, and I'd heard about it quite a bit. Nobody was really talking about it much at that point in time, but you know, I found my way to it and I went down and we had the Ibogaine and the 5-MeO experience, changed my entire life, changed my entire outlook on everything. And, I will never be the same. Psychedelics, man, I think that psychedelics and plant medicines in general, from cannabis up to, you know, Ibogaine and the ayahuasca, the reason those are controlled is because that creates powerful humans that don't need the system. And I think the system is very invested in keeping us locked down, broken, debt slaves, on the broken monetary system and this career, get your gold watch and then travel in your RV for 10 years before you die program that benefits the cabal. You know, it's not what we are supposed to be as humans. It's not how we live. And psychedelics, I think, can open up your understanding to source and to what we really are and the potential in humanity and the things that will bring us to our next stage in enlightenment. So I did it once. It changed everything about everything. And since then, my girl and I, we went down to Costa Rica last New Year's Eve, and we did a ayahuasca retreat, several ceremonies together. And I still touch into the psychedelic world on a fairly regular basis. And every tradition you look back on, every religious tradition, every spiritual tradition, if you go back far enough, you'll find some place where I think that psychedelics or entheogenic substances played a part in somebody's revelation and in some sort of the, as people go through spiritual pathways, you know, it's a progressive kind of thing. And I think psychedelics and the plant medicines play a part in almost all traditions.
Yeah. I've heard a lot about it. I heard that it literally like reprograms neuropathways so that you can just be free again because of life experience or just traumatic experiences can kind of get, they're still there, but they're just rewired, not affecting you as much as they did. And that's why the whole PTSD, TBI world is kind of going down this path. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, when I had the Ibogaine experience, it was, and this is not my analogy, somebody said this, it's like your life, you have all these, it is like if you lived in a little cabin on a snowy hill, and over the course of time, the path you walk to the outhouse and to the stream and the creek and down to the driveway gets imprinted in the snow and gets worn into the snow. And the way you sled, you know, after you sled for a while on a hill, you develop a track. And it's very hard to get out of that track. And the track kind of directs how you go. And having a psychedelic experience like Ibogaine, which is a addiction interrupter, they use it for people that are hardcore heroin addicts and opioid addicts. And within the first 5 minutes of the experience, you are physically and mentally free of addiction. It's like a fresh snowfall over all the old stuff. And the pathways are still there, but now you're able to choose. Do I want to take this path? Or do I want to write a new one? It gives you an opportunity to rewrite. The addictions aren't just the physical addictions or the drug addictions. The addictions it breaks are patterns of thinking, you know, and patterns of feeling, and the way that our brains are wired with these default neural pathways, which kind of create our personality, where, you know, your brain just kind of tends to take these same pathways over and over, and that's the way we think. And then if there's a picture, you know, a book that I read on a brain on psilocybin and a brain normally, and the brain normally, you know, it showed all these pathways and it was very complex, but you could see the pathways were all pretty well-worn. You know, there were only a few parts of the brain that were connected to a few other parts, and there were big lines drawing those. And the other connections were all very small, if they were even there. And then on psilocybin, magic mushrooms, all these pathways just exploded, and different parts of your brain can communicate with other parts that maybe had never communicated before. And so it just creates possibility.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And I've heard a lot of positive stuff from all the guys. Yeah. I mean, I always compare it to like when you said the creative side, right? Most creative or innovative things that have come out are usually, I mean, you know, psychedelics or something was probably involved in history, you know, and you've got everybody from Joe Rogan to, you know, Elon Musk, who definitely believe in it. And I think have claimed it out loud that, yeah, you know, if I'm most of the Elon's greatest thoughts have been probably while he is high or what we would say is high. Or if you look at like Stephen King, I mean, he admittedly says he, you know, he snorted a couple lines of coke and wrote Cujo in 3 days and never slept, you know? So
great book.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think there's like a dozen books he admits that he wrote like in this, I mean, literally in 72 hours, high as a kite, yeah, that are now, you know, bestsellers and big movies.
Cocaine, I think, is a pretty bad deal, but yeah, medicines and stuff, what they can do for people, I highly encourage, you know, people to explore those pathways, because it will open up to you possibilities that you never could have even conceptualized.
Wow. Yeah. No, I might have to check it out someday.
Get a chance to go down to the Mexico, jump in on that. That's a really well done experience.
All right. I'll have to hit you up about that.
Yeah.
We could go on for on and on, I'm sure, with some of your experiences, but for the sake of time, we got to roll into your hypothetical survival scenario, which I know you're going to crush. But I mean, this really is what determines whether or not you survive this podcast. So are you ready, Joel?
All right. I guess I am. All right.
Okay. Get your ball gag ready. Here we go. If you're on an acid trip, well then Joel loves you. More with Joel after the break. For this scenario, you've taken a trip to a cabin in the woods for some meditation and self-reflection. While at the cabin, you decide to walk into the woods and meditate for a while in nature, you know, just take it all in.
Sure.
You bring a map of the woods with you. You start to walk towards the entrance of the woods, and you realize you left your cell phone behind.
Okay, one question first.
Yeah.
Am I naked and am I high?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. All right. That makes
sense. Keep going. we'll go ahead and say yes. You are naked and you are high as a kite. So here we go. First question. Do you A, continue on in the woods and meditate with no devices, or B, go back to the cabin and grab the phone just in case?
I go back and grab the phone for a couple reasons. My meditation timer is on my phone, and I use the ring that connects to app that I usually measure all my heartbeat and respiration and stuff while I meditate.
There we go.
Yes. And plus, okay. Emergency use type
there
stuff.
There we go. Yep. So even though you're taking that time in the woods to quote unquote unplug, yes, we recommend that all guests and listeners, you bring your device just in case you need to dial 911 or whatever. You find a spot far out in the woods to meditate for a solid hour. You decide it's time to head back. You start to walk back in the direction in which you came when out of nowhere, a wild boar, charges you down, right? So do you A, kick the boar in the face, or B, quickly climb a tree?
I would B, quickly climb a tree, if that's an option.
Good choice, yeah. The head and the cape of a wild boar is like armor. It's like body armor.
Yeah.
So kicking it's not going to do anything. Hell, you could shoot that armor, and it's probably not going to do much to it.
Yeah.
Boars,
they're tusks and rip your femoral out before you even...
That's right. Yeah. They can... They've got lethal tusks, and their jaw is strong enough to just crush your bones, you know. Right in place. So yeah, they're dangerous little fuckers. But if you climb a tree and you do it fast enough and you plan for the fact that there are some big boars, boars will use their front, hooves, I guess they call them hooves on a boar, to go up the tree and stand up on their hind legs. So you got to make sure you at least get probably 6 feet or higher and you'll be all right. You just got to wait for the boar to get bored, and leave you alone. You go up the tree,
right.
Good choice. And as you're coming down a tree, you slip and tumble down a steep, rocky decline. Right, you tumble about 35 or 40 feet, and then splash into some river rapids. Okay, it's a bad day. All that meditation's just gone out the window. You end up on a shoal in the middle of the rapids. So, do you A, dive into the water and swim for land, or B, locate a long stick that's gotten stuck up against the shoal and use it to walk across the river?
How do I mean, there's a stick lay across the river? Is it falling down or as a walk?
No, you can use it basically as a third leg.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So river crossing tactics.
Yeah, I absolutely use that as a third leg. Because if I, swimming, you got some potential issues there with the speed and then stuff that's under the water. And if I slip and fall, I'm going to be, the stick can help me avoid all those rocks and stuff as well.
Yeah, there you go. You never really want to dive into the water because if you can't see the bottom, then you break your neck.
Yep.
The long stick, like we mentioned, serves as a third leg. And river crossings, they're not a big deal if you just do it right. And basically you face into the current and you sidestep across and you have that third leg out in front of you. And so a lot of people, what they do is they just try to walk straight across and the current's coming to their left or to their right. And it's very difficult to maintain good footing that way. So you sidestep with your facing into the current, and the odds are you'll make it across just fine. Right. So you make it to the riverbank. Good job.
All right.
With all the adrenaline, you didn't feel any of the pain at the moment because you did fall.
Right.
But then you realize that you've fractured your leg. What the hell? So do you A, move quickly to find your way out of the woods and get help, or B, just you got to start addressing the wound?
I start addressing the wound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. B.
I mean, unless there's a situation where I got to get off the X, you got to deal with
another boar.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got another boar.
No,
not yet. Okay. So. By moving quickly on the damaged leg, you could just make the injury worse. So it's better to stop and take a moment and do what you can to fix yourself.
Right.
So you had some 550 cord with you, and you go ahead and grab some sticks and you splint you know, your leg, and now you're a little more mobile.
Right.
You also take this time to consult your map and check out, okay, where have I ended up? And according to the map, you can make your way back up the incline to find your way back, but it will it'll be about a quarter of a mile back to safety. Or you can take the long way and stay on flat ground, and it's about a half a mile to safety. So do you, A, go up the incline for the quarter mile, or do you go, B, you take the flat route that's a half mile?
I would form a crutch out of whatever branch I could find, so I have the stability on my broken leg, and I would take the long way back.
That's a good answer, B. You know, so this question really is all about energy conservation, as well as avoiding the steep incline, because it's the one thing that broke your leg. It doesn't really make sense to try and go back up it.
Exactly, broken leg.
So the flat route may be longer, but you know, you're injured, and another quarter mile is probably the better choice. So as you proceed the flat route, you come across several dead human bodies.
Oh wow, okay.
So do you A, investigate the bodies, checking for IDs and functioning cell phones and supplies, or B, just get the fuck out of there?
Is it obvious what has caused their death?
Not yet.
Okay. You know, I think
do you want to touch them is the question.
Yeah. the situation is dependent mostly on how much pain I'm feeling and how much energy I have. If I feel really good, I would probably do a cursory checkout. You know, I wouldn't get too involved in it. I would mark the spot if my device is still working, and I'd probably keep going. And then I wouldn't want to disturb the scene, and I wouldn't want to get too close to something that I don't know what the cause of death was.
Yeah, you're correct. It's probably better to just keep on moving. Right?
Yeah.
And especially for this scenario, okay, there's several reasons not to mess with a bunch of dead bodies, you know, you find in the woods. You know, looking for survival tools and this and that in the real world is probably a good idea, but this hypothetical world, it's not a good idea. 'Cause whatever killed them may be nearby or coming back. That's one consideration.
Sure.
So you don't want to hang out in the area for any extended period of time.
Maybe contagious.
What's that?
Be contagious.
That's right. It could be contagious. So you pick up the pace and you keep on moving like, okay, I don't want to end up with these freaks. You're now approaching the edge of the forest and your cabin is not that far away. You're out of the woods and approaching the cabin. You're about 30 feet from the cabin and you hear from behind you this groan. Okay. And you look back and those dead bodies are reanimated and appear to be headed towards you. And they might even have their hands out in front of them and, you know, kind of coming towards you like a zombie. So it is getting in the Halloween spirit here. So do you A, run towards the back of the cabin where your car is parked about 60 feet away, or B, just get inside? That's because that's only about 30 feet.
Oh, shit. I guess it would depend on how well I'm feeling, because I think the better choice is to get in the car and get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
We've all seen zombie movies in the cabin. We all know it doesn't really work out well for the people staying in the cabin.
Yep.
But it depends on what I think I can do. You know,
yeah.
If I'm making it the 60 feet, well, zombies are slow, unless these are fast zombies. If they're the slow zombies, normal zombies, and I can outrun them and I feel like I can, I'm going to get in my car and Didi Mao the fuck out of there.
Well, there's 33 kinds of zombies, and these are the fast twitch. These are the ones that just fucking run. They run so freaking fast, you just no way you're going to outrun.
Yeah, then I think I'm going to get in the cabin.
There you go. B. You know what's funny? And, you know, one of the listeners, they made a comment on one of my posts, and they said, "The answer is always B, Clint. The answer is always B." So Somebody has figured this thing out, because I'm sitting here looking at this sheet going, you know what? They're right. Every single time it's B. We might have to switch that up a little. So the entrance of the cabin is much closer, and your car keys are inside.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah.
There you go.
So we got to consider that part, right?
Yeah,
so
that's right.
The zombies are coming your way, and almost at the entrance of the cabin, do you A, search the house for weapons, or B, block the door first?
Block the door, man.
That's right. Block that damn door.
Got to stop the advance.
That's right. You know, weapons are important. We all know it and we love them, but you have to stop them from getting inside first. So, you know, this actual skill applies to, you know, active shooter scenarios when you have to barricade a door. You want to do it properly. And so it's creating basically a chain of furniture from the door to the opposing wall, right? You just put anything you can stacked all together. So something against the door, something behind that, and something behind that, all the way to the opposite wall. That wall then becomes your doorstop, and there's no way anybody's getting in that door. And that's the proper way to barricade a door. Most people think you just stack stuff up in front of it, and that does nothing but fall over. Yeah. All right. So next.
Very little rubber doorstops, too. So if I have
hell those. Yeah. Yeah, I like those. You know, if you've got about six of those things and you put them two at the top, two on the locking side and two at the bottom, I mean, it makes that makes a door very difficult to open.
So
do you next A, hide inside the house and hope the zombies don't get in, or B, make a calculated escape, which you're a pro at, out the back of the house and rush for your vehicle?
I would somehow try to set up whatever distraction I could to draw their attention away, and I would see if I could get to the car, because, you know, zombies in cabins in the wood. It's not
right. Yeah, this is a horror movie that isn't going to end well. So, yes, go to the car.
Yes.
Before you get to the car, you encounter a couple of these zombies, and which you bash in the skull and with the bat you grabbed, because we all love bats.
Uh-huh.
And now you've made your way into the vehicle, you start it up, you floor it, you mow down a couple of more zombies on your way out.
Last question.
So do you A, get on the highway and don't stop driving until you're as far out of town as possible, or B, go to a nearby military base that you notice and drive there instead?
Depending on the condition of the vehicle and the gas and all of that, I would go as far as possible, because you don't know, the infection might have come from the military. They might be in on this.
Yeah, exactly.
Distance.
Last thing you want to do is face zombies with M4s or any kind
yeah,
of rifle.
Exactly.
fast twitch zombies with weapons. That's not a good day.
That's bad.
Awesome, man. Well, you did. You nailed it. You survived this podcast, and a lot of great information, man. You are several encyclopedias of experience and good info, and I appreciate your time on here. So, where can people find you? What do you have going on these days that you'd like to let everybody know about?
Well, the thing I'm most excited about is after Manhunt and everything died down, I had gotten a motorcycle accident. And wasn't able to continue doing that. I had people ask me all the time, when are you going to, you know, do a celebrity edition of Manhunt and take a celebrity with you on a hunt, or, you know, take people out or teach them how to do these things. And I'm thinking, man, I get compromised so much just because I have a cameraman with me. There's no way I'm going to take Kim Kardashian or anything out on a.
That would be interesting.
But I was thinking of ways to have people participate and teach them some of the skills, the escape and evasion, the deception trails, the booby traps and stuff like that. And I came up with an idea for an augmented reality game. And for those that aren't familiar, virtual reality is, of course, when you're immersed in a completely different world with sensory deprivation type equipment. Augmented reality is digital overlays over the real world. So advertising, information, guidance, translations, things like that. And augmented reality gaming is the next huge thing. All the big companies, Samsung, Google, Apple, are spending billions of dollars into their hardware and their software for augmented reality. And so, in fact, Pokemon Go is the top augmented reality game right now. Last year, it made $2 billion worldwide just on in-app purchases and stuff. It's insane. Damn.
It's amazing. That's still going, still going,
Pokemon. Still going. It's going more than it was when people were hearing about it. But there are several other augmented reality games. They're not good games. They're not very, very many good games out, but what they are is, they make the low end ones make from $17 to $35 million a year on these augmented reality games. So I create figured escape and evasion, tracking, booby traps, and deception trails are perfect for augmented reality because you can overlay those onto any sidewalk, onto any street, onto any kind of experience. And so I created a game, a mobile augmented reality game based on escape and evasion, based on the skill sets I used in Manhunt, where people would create their avatar, they would track people through their hometowns, through their neighborhoods, solving and avoiding booby traps and solving deception trails, and ultimately trying to take down their quarry before they make it to their extract point and get away. There's a whole storyline. It's a whole game that we've created. I pitched it to a few people and they lost their minds. They were super excited. So we got a venture capital firm on board, got some lawyers, got some other partners and some augmented reality studios and stuff on board. And so we're going ahead and we're building Escape and Evade Mobile. And so people can go to Escape and Evade Mobile, escapeandevademobile.com, and sign up for updates and everything. And we'll keep you in the loop on everything that's happening. It's very exciting. It's a huge emerging tech and a huge, the money that they've forecast for augmented reality in general and gaming specifically and the mobile world is mind-boggling. And so we're creating something that is one of the, it's uniquely situated to show all the capabilities of augmented reality while people experience a really fun gameplay. And so that's what I'm working on now. I'm not doing really any other on-camera stuff, a few things here and there, but the game is what we're doing. So escapeandevademobile.com.
Wow. That sounds pretty cool. So let me get this right. You're going to be able to, are you using your phone or are you putting on goggles and walking down the street?
That's right now it's the phone, but with Apple Glass and all the other ones coming out, that is where it's all going to be. Cause then you're going to be like, Ethan, what's his name? And those,
Ethan Hawke
or the computer screens up there and you're swiping and you're touching.
Interacting
like that. So that's what's going to be happening with all this other hardware. But right now, even with just a mobile phone, so you download the game, it's free to play. You create an account, you create your avatar, you've got different slots that you can fill up, like speed versus stealth, speed, load, things like that. And that'll affect your gameplay. And then you walk outside your house, start game, and you start looking around. And the haptic feedback and everything on your device will give you clues until you see, okay, over there, there's a little blinking yellow light. Well, that's a little smudge. There's a little spore. And then you follow that to the next broken twig or footprint. And avoiding booby traps, because there's booby traps around. You can play, you'll be able to play dogs, you'll be able to play drones, you'll be able to play all this different stuff that you acquire as you play through. There's a whole storyline for the story that you're playing. And then you can play against your friends and stuff. You can form guilds and teams. So I have a hunter force team, and then somebody else, three streets over is an escape and evasion guy. So boom, ping him, invite for hunt. And then we actually play against your friends or people you don't know or guilds globally. And another cool thing that we created in this to make sure everybody can play is that if you are physically limited, a kid in Dayton, Ohio, who maybe is in a wheelchair or maybe just can't get outside or his mom won't let him, he can on his laptop or his desktop create hunts using Google Maps and Google Street Views in Barcelona or Paris, and people can play his hunt. He can create the booby traps. He can create the trails. He can create the deceptions. He can create all the stuff, and people can play against him. And the online communities, they talk shit and get their points and everything. So it's a whole community of people.
Man, that is genius. That sounds like a whole lot of fun. Like, and that I see kids, adults, everybody enjoying that, and
get people outside.
You're getting your, what is it? The little, everyone's wearing the wristwatch that counts how many steps people are getting their steps in. Dude, that is.
Get outside. So it's basically the world's most complicated and exciting game of hide and seek played against the computer or with your friends in locations.
Yeah, that is awesome. Escapeandevademobile.com. Everyone check that out. That sounds like a ton of fun. I'm going to have to check it out myself. And then, of course, you can just check out Joel Lambert. You can search his name on social media, or you can just go to who I follow, and you'll see him right there. But Joel, hey, once again, thanks for coming on board. Appreciate all your wisdom, experiences. It was awesome hanging out with you.
Glenn, thank you.
Yeah. And like I always say, hey, keep it simple out there, because crisis will complicate the rest, and we will talk to you next time. Can You Survive This Podcast is a production of Calvary Audio and iHeartMedia. Recorded live from a secure location here in Dallas, Texas. Produced by Brandon Morgan, Jeff Apple, and Clint Emerson. Executive produced by Keegan Rosenberger and Dana Brunetti. For Calvary Audio, I'm Clint Emerson.